This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
Very large structural changes are afoot. One of the biggest sets of those and all the implications related thereto is around this idea that we're past the peak of cheap and easy oil.
Author, economic analyst, scientist, and futurist Chris Martinson has written and spoken extensively on key issues surrounding our energy-based economy. He appeared on this show 4 years ago, when high oil prices were making headlines. Those headlines have returned, and we check back with Martinson today to get his take on how things have progressed or regressed in the fight for a clean energy future. A fellow at the Post-Carbon Institute, Martinson shares his thoughts on rising oil prices and the danger of ignoring the realities of peak oil, this week on Sea Change Radio. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Chris Martinson. He's an economic analyst and futurist. He's a fellow at the Post-Carbon Institute. He's a former scientist and businessman. People can learn more about him at chrismartinson.com. Chris, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Alex, it's a pleasure to be here.
When you were last on the show, Chris, you spoke about economic, environmental, and energy hockey sticks with Bill Bowie. And also, in part two, you talked about decoupling growth from prosperity. This was 2008. Maybe give our listeners who missed that a review of some of those theories and how you think they've played out in the last 3-4 years.
Be happy to. You know, in 2008, actually this work I started began for me in around 2003. By 2005, I'd quit my job to talk to people about what I saw were looming economic issues. I was talking about crazy stuff, just crazy. Housing bubble when everybody thought there was nothing but upward momentum on house prices. I was talking about gold almost $1,000 ago in price. I was talking about how we were going to have an enormous credit contraction. These were all things that were not really very obvious last time I was on Sea Change Radio. Now they've all sort of become obvious. And I wish I could take credit for having been a super genius or something. But really what I do, Alex, is I look at the trends. And when I see something that's really out of line or out of whack or unsustainable, I have this bias which says anything that's unsustainable will someday stop. So in the housing bubble, my warning clues were things like hearing about the hairdresser in Las Vegas who was buying her 19th property in order to be able to flip it. That's just an example of something that gives you a little anecdote that says, you know, these house prices that have been going up to high double digits for almost 8 years now is an unsustainable trend. It will stop. And so this is really the nature of the work I do. When I say I'm a futurist, in many ways I'm an extrapolatist. You know, I just take where things are headed and say that's probably where they're going to keep going. So there at the beginning of the Obama administration, I was quite bearish on the overall markets. I was very worried about the credit markets. I thought we had a lot of difficulty in front of us. My diagnosis at that point in time has not changed. I diagnosed our economic ills as three words. I can do it all in three words. Too much debt. And I stand by that. And so, you know, since that's my diagnosis, you can imagine I completely disagree with the prescription that's been applied, which is more debt. You know, we're just taking all the debt that's not being created and households purchasing things they don't need. And the public sector has stepped in with the government taking on trillion-plus-dollar deficits. And not just here in the U.S., this is kind of a global phenomenon. And so I look at where we are today and compared to where we were those 4 years ago, and I say, in some ways, some things have changed importantly. People know now that the system has some serious crevices in it, and they're paying more attention. So I have more traction in my work. I get to speak at nicer places, and the audiences are larger, and they're paying a bit more attention. That's all good. What's not good in this story is that where we had an opportunity in 2008 to really correct some of the imbalances, some of the gross misadjustments that had been applied to the economy, like having too much debt, like having a trade balance that was deeply negative for the U.S., like having heavy concentration of debt and risk in certain parties, like, you know, some big banks or certain regions of the world, all of those things that we had an opportunity to unwind. We didn't. In most cases, we made them more risky, more dangerous, and just a little bit further over the edge. And so we squandered an opportunity to, A, hold the people accountable who took the risks. You know, the big banks weren't allowed to fail. The bonuses were preserved. Nobody lost their jobs. Nobody went to jail, things like that. And allowed the system to grow even larger. We have $100 trillion more in derivatives today than we did in 2008 when the crisis first broke. And most importantly, though, we squandered time. The time to really take stock of where we are in this predicament, because I've just been talking about the first D, the economy, but energy. We are 4 years further along in the energy story. The data is 4 years more confirmatory in terms of where we are in a global landscape for petroleum. We've not gone about investing the extraordinary amounts of money that are going to be required to wean us off of an oil-based transportation system into something else, maybe natural gas, who knows, electric cars, living closer to where we work, eat, and play, who knows, combination of all those things. So, you know, over these past 4 years, what's happened? Unfortunately, a lot of the things I thought were going to happen happened, and none of the things I was hoping were going to happen happened.
4 years ago, oil prices, I remember, were in the news because they had gone through the roof in terms of the public's perception of where they should be. Oil was around $115, $120 a barrel. And then it kind of leveled off and went down quite a bit over the last 4 years. But where are we now? Oil's at $115, $120 a barrel. So that was supposed to just be an aberration. But it's more than that, in your opinion, correct?
Correct. You know, a lot of people will pull up a chart of oil and console themselves with the idea that there was this big spike in prices that ramped up and peaked out in July of 2008 at $147 a barrel. But, you know, and then it collapsed all the way down to $38 a barrel over the next year. So some people will look at that and see, oil prices just volatile. But if we widen the chart out and we go back 10 years, we see that, in fact, oil prices have been rising very steadily. You can put a ruler on it and draw a nice straight line between 10 years ago and today. And yes, 2008 is a blip. It's a cardio blip, both up and down, overshoot, undershoot. But we're back right on that trend line, which says we've been facing steadily, persistently rising prices for quite a while now. And that's really a mystery in this whole thing because, you know, across that same span of time, we've had good economic times and bad economic times. We've had deflationary episodes and inflationary episodes. We've got QE going on, which is the quantitative easing or the printing of money by central banks. We have all these exogenous forces that should be making oil wiggle a lot more than it is, but it's not. It's kind of steadily getting more and more expensive. I trust everybody who's listening to this is aware of gasoline prices today and where those are in, you know, relation to just a year ago or 10 years ago. And that's really an important part of the story that just gets missed a lot of times because it's the whole proverbial frog boiling in the pot of water metaphor. You know, if you took somebody from 10 years ago and dropped them into today's environment, I think they'd be shocked. You know, they would jump right out of the pot and go, ouch, that's really hot. Look how much people are paying for heating oil, for transportation fuels, for their energy needs. And this is a trend that's in play. And my prediction, my analysis, my work, my extrapolations, however we want to characterize what I do, all say that this is not a temporary phenomenon. It's not going to be subject to any policy tweaks. We're not going to drill our way out of this. It's not going to be something that we're going to legislate away. We simply are in a persistently higher and probably higher and higher energy cost structure, literally from now for the rest of time.
When you look at oil prices, the reason given for the daily dips and spikes generally seems to be based on general economic news. And oil has been put as one of these counterintuitive barometers. So do you see it that way? Or you think I'm assuming it's a lot more complicated than just good economy means lower oil prices, bad economy equals higher oil prices?
Alex, I wish it was as simple as the headlines make it out. You know, the headline writers at the financial outlets are always trying to assign causality. You know, oil's up today because the Iranian minister said something disparaging and we're worried about war, you know, or Britney Spears is just canceled her next tour. Or they connect it to something. That's the noise in the system. The signal in the system is the idea that since 2005, despite the fact that oil has basically tripled in price, output has flatlined. And so really all markets for commodities, of which oil is the master commodity, is really set on its long-term trend by supply and demand. If suddenly the world was flooded with cheap oil of the grade we wanted, trust me, the price would go down irrespective of whatever was in the news. The news does wiggle it around. You will get spikes and pops and wiggles and dips, and all of that will be true. But ultimately, those aren't the things that are making the trend. Is the longer trend up or down? That's supply and demand in our system. And oil is very clearly in tight supply. And this is the critical part. This is where the oil story is not as simple as we look at it in the newspapers. There isn't this thing called oil. It turns out there's all these different grades of oil, ranging from really, really poor stuff we hate to have, just it's gunk, to really, really beautiful stuff that light and sweet that we really
which
love.
Which is one of the reasons why we went into Libya, right? Because they have the light, sweet crude for airline fuel.
We love light, sweet crude because what it turns out, we build these big, giant, multi-billion dollar things called refineries, and it turns out they're tuned for a specific grade of oil. You can build them for heavy sour. You can build them for light, sweet. All the ones that we really have and care about are mostly tuned to light, sweet. And for whatever reason, nobody's building new refineries around the heavy sour crude except for Asia. So we have a situation where the grades of crude that the West wants, the OECD countries, Europe, Japan, US, what we really want is light, sweet. And that's in really short supply. And here's the mysterious part. It's in short supply despite the prices tripling. Couple ways to look at that. There's a big, giant global conspiracy, involves every producing nation, involves every independent producer. They've all decided to just hold that grade back from the markets. Or we might just not have as much of that grade as available as we used to have because we've depleted our primary reserves of that. In this story, everything I've analyzed, all the data says B is the correct story. We've actually run through all the cheap and easy, easily accessed grades of light sweet. And what we do have available and remaining, it's not running out today or tomorrow. There's still quite a bit of it, but we can't pump it out faster and faster anymore for geological reasons, not geopolitical. Geological reasons. That's where we are in this story. That's what you open up the paper and see $122 per barrel Brent crude. It's telling you that we are in short supply for that grade of crude, period. And that's really the big story here, because when we look at like what's going on in Greece, it's a horrible story. They're in a depression with a capital D. There are people actually starving there now. They're short on medicine. It's just a complete mess. And when we peer into that, every single rescue plan that's being put forward by the ECB bureaucrats and administrators, all of them count in their plans that Greece is going to get back to growth, and they're going to do it soon, next year, and then they're going to grow forever, 2%, 3%. The whole world is counting on this growth. We all need the growth. We hear about the growth. We have to have the growth. I don't know how we grow, first of all, under high energy prices, and second of all, we have exactly zero historical examples where we have had an economic recovery in the globe when oil prices have been this high. And that's on an inflation-adjusted basis. So oil got to close around $100 a barrel back in the 70s on an inflation-adjusted basis. So what I'm saying is that when we look at oil prices where they are today, compare it by inflation adjusting to any other period of history, we've never had an economic recovery at these levels. And everybody is counting on recovery. And that's the substance of my work, is saying if everybody's counting on something and it might not happen, then what?
Let's talk it over. Let's get it straight. Don't let the situation escalate. You know there's always problems when a man is wrapped up in his heart. But don't you worry, baby, you can count on me to do my part.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking with economic analyst and futurist Chris Martinson. Chris, you penned a fascinating piece earlier this week on your website, chrismartinson.com, entitled Dangerous Ideas. First, why don't you give us a little overview of this, and then I'll tell you some of the things that it made me think about.
Okay, sure. First, a quick term, peak oil. When we talk about peak oil, we're talking about the idea that at some point in a given field of oil that we're pumping out of, you will hit a maximum rate of production and then it will start falling off. So peak oil is not about running out of oil, but it's around the idea that whenever we observe any individual field or collection of fields or any sets of fields, that they tend to ramp up in total flow rates, and then they hit a peak and they tend to ramp down again.
I think the term theory, when applied to peak oil, as you observe, is one that has really pushed back the reality of the situation into a very similar debate between like intelligent design and evolution. That peak oil is not a theory, it's a fact, because as you mentioned in the piece, there is a finite amount of oil, and at some point it's going to run out. Now, the theory may be when this oil will run out, but by attaching that term theory, it becomes a very debatable point, whether or not it should be debatable.
Well, it's certainly absolutely not under debate. Peak oil is an observation, and it's a set of facts. And we have decades of facts. We have thousands of data points. We've seen thousands of individual fields go past peak. Out of the 54 producing nations, we've seen 45 of them go past peak. This is very well characterized. So you're right. When we attach the word theory to it, all of a sudden, it casts some doubt on the whole thing, because sometimes theories are wrong. And so the dangerous ideas I was referring to in that piece are, I noted in that article too, but I found a total of 7 articles that all came out in this past week that directly called into question peak oil as a theory. And the titles were very descriptive. They said, peak oil theory proved wrong.
The end of the peak oil theory on Fool.com, the Motley Fool. These are people who are read by thousands or hundreds of thousands of people. And when you have a title like The End of the Peak Oil Theory, what does that tell to the investor class?
Well, it directly calls into question this whole idea that peak oil is real and is actually stating in the title it's not. And I found articles like that in Forbes and Reuters and other places, like you said, very well read. So here's the dangerous idea. To me, if you call into question this idea that peak oil is a theory is wrong, and you give some ideas why you think that's wrong, if you happen to hold that as your central idea now, and I internalize that, I say, oh, okay, that my new belief is that peak oil is just a theory and it's debatable and I no longer believe in it. Like, you know, I can just decide to not believe in it. I'll start doing some very different things. Like, well, I guess I don't need to really worry about energy prices going up next year and the year after that. They will probably come back down again. I don't have to worry about being efficient. Maybe I'll buy an SUV, not a more efficient vehicle. I'm not actually going to think as hard about how far away I live and work and play, how far away those things are from each other. There's all sorts of decisions that can flow off of holding your core belief as saying, peak oil is just a theory and it's been proven wrong. That's a dangerous idea.
And when you watch the political process unfold here, this circus we call the Republican debates, and just the general tenor of what's happened in terms of the propaganda machine, as you refer to in this dangerous ideas, what can we do besides just bang our head against the wall in frustration when we hear drill, baby, drill is the answer?
Well, the first thing I counsel anybody to do, whether it's a corporation or an individual or whomever, an institution, is we absolutely cannot wait for a solution to come out of Washington. You know, I read Obama's most recent speech on energy policy, and the words were all good. You know, we have to make greater use of this natural gas, which we've got a lot of for the moment, and it's very clean, and that's all wonderful. But we're not actually doing anything. When you look at the actual budget allocations that have been proposed for these things, the words and the priorities in terms of spending are not lining up. If we really wanted to take our country to this brighter future that I see that's possible, what we would do is we would say, listen, we only have so much of this fossil fuel bequeathment, whether it's natural gas or petroleum or coal. We only have so much. You burn it once, it's gone. So how do we want to use this? Well, tell you what, looks like this stuff is going to run out, and I do mean run out, in 10 or 20 or 30 years or 40 years. At some point it runs out. The question we should be asking is, where do we want to be in 40 years? Okay, well, here's what we'll have to do to get there. Here's what we'll have to start spending. And if you took that as your view, literally our entire budget would have to get reprioritized. We'd have to look at this as the equivalent of a Manhattan Project times an Apollo Project times 10. It's some big giant thing that says, you know, if we really want to shift to an electricity-based, society, which is what all of our alternative energy sources provide us, electricity, not liquid fuels, unfortunately, And that's where we wanted to head. Well, we need all new distribution grids, and we're going to need all sorts of new ways of moving the power around and managing the power. We're going to need to, you know, just there's a million things we need to be doing. And we're not doing that. So when I look at what's going on with drill, baby, drill, really that's just shorthand for saying status quo, baby, status quo. And that's unsustainable, and it will stop. And so when I look at that, every time I hear drill, baby, drill, I or its equivalent expressed, whether it's a fancy rhetoric piece without any attached funding, I go, listen, all the people in power right now, at least in public, are saying we're going to preserve the status quo. And when I look down that status quo road, I see us sort of muddling along until circumstances force us to take stock and do something different. Unfortunately, when you run into an energy crisis, what you have available to you at the end of that road, when you're finally forced by circumstances to do something different, what you have left is a really unappealing, rather smaller set of options that really stink compared to what you could have done just a few years ago. So when I talk about squandering time, that's really one of the critical things I most deplore about wasting time, is that with the passage of time, what we can do shrinks and becomes less palatable. So, simple example, think of what Greece could have done 2 years ago when its two-year bonds were trading at 3% versus today when its two-year bonds are trading at something silly. I forget what it is, 400 or 500%. Greece has almost no options before it. Is it going to cut really deeply or cut super deeply? Are they going to suffer through a capital D depression or something worse? I mean, those are its option sets now compared to where it was a few years ago. That's exactly analogous to where I see us in both the energy and the economic stories today.
Jehoshaphat, the Mongol cat, jumped off the roof today. Some say he fell, but I could tell he did himself away. His eyes weren't bright like they were the night we played checkers on the train. Well, God bless his soul, it was a tootsie roll, but he's a dead cat just the same. We are living in the future, I'll tell you how I know. I read it in the paper 15 years ago. But we're all driving rocket ships and talking with our minds and wearing turquoise jewelry, standing in Supland. We're standing in Supland.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking with economic analyst and futurist Chris Martinson. You conclude the second part of your Dangerous Ideas piece by saying that right now, quote, all I am sure of is that the data does not support the notion that the prior model of global growth fueled by cheap and abundant energy coupled with outrageous increases in debt loads can be resurrected. That model is broken. And we spoke to Václav Smil, who's also a futurist and expert in energy in Alberta, Canada. And he spoke about how he doesn't believe that electric vehicles are really the future because it'll take 50 years to really change those fleets. And he writes that these shifts are 40, 50-year cycles in terms of overhauling a global system. That sounds like a long time, but as we've seen, as nothing's changed in this last 4 years, 40, 50 years isn't as long as people think, and it takes a long time to make these changes.
Yeah, there's two concepts in there, both important. And the first I'll get to is the idea that when somebody says we have 100 years of natural gas, there should be an asterisk at the end of that sentence, which goes to a footnote, which reads, at current rates of consumption. Because we do have 100 years of gas at how we're using it. But trust me, if we decided to run 50% of our vehicle fleet on natural gas, we wouldn't have 100 years left anymore. We'd have a fraction of that. We'd have 20, maybe 10. Because we use almost no natural gas for transportation, which is very energy piggish, right?
That's a really good point. Yeah, we never think about that. So 100 years at current consumption if we don't drive with it.
Right. And, oh, by the way, none of our economic models can stand 0% growth. So it is implicit and it is expected that we are not going to be consuming at current rates of consumption going forward, period. That's also implicit and explicit in our model. So it's just always silly to me when they say we have 100 years and they don't have that addendum on there, which is at current rates of consumption, because that tells me they don't really know what they're talking about. That's my first clue. Like, oh, I can ignore that piece of evident data right now. And then the second piece is around, again, this idea of growth and what we need. And so here's the thing. You don't have to have an economic model that has to grow. But because of our money system, because of how we've chosen to organize ourselves around the type of money we have, which is debt-based money, growth is actually an imperative. It's essential. Without growth, our system shudders and shakes and threatens, you know, to throw a big hissy fit and then finally fly apart. That's absolutely the case. And I could spend all day telling you why that is, and we could talk about it. But if we can just accept the idea that growth is so deeply embedded in our lexicon, our institutional thinking, our models, everything, it really all comes down to this idea of looking at the data as we see it today and asking the question, not can we grow infinitely forever, because any school child can tell you that's impossible in a finite system. We know we live in a finite world. The question is, when are we going to make that transition and how? And the only two options I see are on our own terms or on nature's terms. We either face a future shaped by design or by disaster. And that's really where my work comes in, because I think if we hold the right narrative, we can say, look, there's a direction we can head in that gives us lots of very purpose-filled jobs. We can feel really good about them. We might be consuming less, but we might actually find a way to have a higher quality of life. All of this is definitely within our capability set. But what is not going to work out is if we say, no, we're not going to do anything fundamentally different until forced to. It's status quo until then. We need growth. We need jobs. We need the old paradigm to work. We need more people consuming more things. We have to have jobs. We'll solve that set of crises first before we talk about any of that crazy non-growth stuff you're talking about. First, let's get everything growing again. Then we'll have the conversation. It turns out we don't have this conversation in moments of crisis because it's a bad time, and then we don't do it when times are good because that's a bad time too. It's never a good time. And so bottom line is, sooner or later, if you have a growth-based economic system, it's going to run into a limit to growth, and it's going to be a very unpleasant experience. But I no longer can say when. It's happening right now. We are right in the middle of what this feels like, and it's not going to be an event. It's not something that happens next Tuesday at 8:30. It's over by 8:35 in the morning. This is a process, and it's going to take a long time to unfold. And this is what we are in the middle of right now. And it's the kind of thing where, like that frog boiling in the water, 10 years from now, my prediction is people will look back and go, wow, how did we ever have so much back then? Look where we are today. And in 10 more years, they'll go, oh man, how did we end up here? And that'll happen because we're failing to A, diagnose the predicament we're in properly, and B, respond intelligently like we can. That's the frustrating part to me when you hear the edge in my voice, is because we can do better. We can think this through. We can understand the data. There's no beliefs involved in this. Lots of this is science. It's thermodynamics. It's understanding how much energy you've got, and it goes away, and you get to use it once, and simple concepts. But we seem to be unable to get our minds, we collectively, the larger culture, around the idea that this is where we happen to be. So when you asked before, you know, what do we do when we see, you know, either party not really addressing this and having vacuous statements on both sides of the aisle, in my opinion, what do we do? I think we say, well, we'll hope they do better in the future, but we're not going to plan on it. Our job is to get our lives as resilient as we possibly can, for ourselves to understand where we are in this story to the best of our ability, whether the we is an individual, an institution, a fund, a corporation, whoever's capable of holding these sets of ideas and asking the most important question, which is, how do I become more resilient? What are the risks? What kinds of things should I start doing? What should I stop doing? What kind of new things, or what things should I continue doing? You know, there are a lot of responses we can and should be making. And the good news is people are doing this all over the place. There are whole communities out there that have looked into this and said, we're not waiting. We're just going to go right ahead and make ourselves more resilient, because it's just completely obvious where we are in this story and where we're headed.
Chris Martinson, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Alex, it's been my pleasure.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Samford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Brian Eno, John Prine, and Mose Allison. Sea Change Radio is made possible by support from Farm Fresh to You Organic Produce Delivery Service, connecting people to farms and leading the progressive change in America's food system. To learn more, go to farmfreshtoyou.com. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.